Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Misfire, The Sarajevo Assassination and the Winding Road to World War I, by Paul Miller Melamed. Narrated by Rick Adamson. Publisher's Note: This audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. But is not the pastness of the past that much more profound, complete, and fabulous the closer it is to the present? And it may well be that our history, by its very nature, shares some other things with fables as well. Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain. Introduction. I could have practically touched him. There is nothing intrinsically meaningless or inane about chance, nothing that would carry with it the necessary implication of an idiot universe. Chance simply signifies the particularity of historical process. The Reverend Dr. John Polkinghorne, Science and Theology. The sky was overcast and ominous, the country rugged and rebellious. The day's program was long and arduous, the sovereign august and aged. When his realm annexed the region less than 2 years earlier, world war had nearly ensued. But with tensions having diminished between the European great powers, Kaiser Franz Joseph I was ready to make an official appearance before his newest subjects in the Habsburg Empire. On the afternoon of May 31, 1910, after a triumphal train ride into Bosnia-Herzegovina, he proceeded by ceremonial carriage through the crowded streets of its capital city, Sarajevo. Despite a driving rain shower, the imperial pageant went off wondrously. Indeed, the emperor's three-day Bosnian trip was a tremendous success, with its full schedule of state receptions, military inspections, and meetings with leaders of Bosnia's multiple religious national communities, Orthodox Serbian, Catholic Croatian, Muslim, and Jewish. On his journey home through Herzegovina, Franz Josef even made time to admire the old bridge in Mostar, an enduring landmark constructed in the 16th century by the country's previous rulers, the Ottoman Turks. By all accounts, the 79-year-old Emperor of Austria and King of Hungary so thoroughly enjoyed himself in his southernmost Slavic domains that at one point he turned to his host, Bosnian Governor General Marijan Varishanin, and exclaimed, "I assure you, this voyage has made me some 20 years younger." In fact, it nearly ended his life more than 6 years prematurely. For while security was far tighter than it would be when Franz Josef's nephew and successor, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, made his infinitely more infamous visit to Bosnia and procession through Sarajevo 4 years later, an armed nationalist named Bogdan Jerajic was stalking His Highness. On two occasions, the Bosnian student got so close to the resplendent Kaiser that he dejectedly confided to a friend, "I could have practically touched him." Yet Jerajic failed to pull the Browning pistol from his pocket. Instead, on June 15th, perhaps as much out of personal anguish as patriotic ardor, the 24-year-old fired five near misses at Varishanin as he was leaving the newly inaugurated Diet in Sarajevo. His last shot was precise, shattering his own skull and making him a martyr figure for Bosnian freedom from Habsburg rule. Unlike his hero Jerajic, on whose grave he swore an oath of revenge, the 19-year-old Bosnian Gavrilo Princip did not lose his nerve when he came within point-blank range of Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand. Yet he nearly lost his opportunity. On June 28, 1914, a sunny summer day that is routinely described as cloudless, carefree, peaceful, and perfect all across Europe, Princip was lurking amid the crowd lining the route of the Archduke's procession when an ear-splitting explosion sliced through the spectacle. Further down the Appel K road, Princip's accomplice, Nedeljko Chabrinovich, had tossed a bomb at the touring car carrying Franz Ferdinand and his wife, the Duchess of Hohenberg. Some observers confused the bomb with the booming cannons saluting the royal entry into the city. Princip, however, was only uncertain whether the Archduke was still alive. That became clearer soon after the prominent green plumage of the heir's ceremonial headdress fluttered past him in the open-air auto. Franz Ferdinand narrowly survived an assassination attempt in Sarajevo that day. Gavrilo Princip, meanwhile, had not even gotten off a shot. Chabrinovich was quickly apprehended while the remaining assassins backed down or bolted altogether. Princip was the exception. Instead of slinking into the crowd and hightailing it out of town, he took up his secondary post directly across the quay, on the corner where it ran into, ironically, Kaiser Franz Josef Street, just in front of Moritz Schiller's delicatessen. But the steadfast assassin did not stop for a sandwich. From the well-publicized route of the imperial procession, Princip knew this to be the precise place where the cars would turn off the Appel K and into central Sarajevo after the official reception in City Hall. And on cue, the first two cars did turn there, followed by the one carrying Franz Ferdinand. Then, something that was not scheduled suddenly happened. Bosnian Governor-General Oskar Potiorek, who was seated nearest to the Archduke, cried, "Why, you are driving the wrong way!" Chauffeur Leopold Loika obeyed his command to reverse and hit the brakes. Gavrilo Princip obeyed his conscience and drew his Browning. Only instead of aiming at a moving target, he had a sitting duck with plush green plumage right in front of him. History enthusiasts have made much of this wrong turn. After all, if not for Chabrinovich's attempt, then when the imperial party convened in City Hall, Potiorek would not have altered the itinerary to avoid the narrow streets of the city center and instead follow the Appel K directly to the garrison hospital to visit the adjutant injured in the explosion. And had he not revised the route, then when the Archduke's auto accidentally turned, as initially planned, onto Franz Josef Street, Loika would not have been ordered to reverse course. And had he not halted at that very corner, then Princip, who at such close range still fired his first bullet right through the car's body, inadvertently killing the Duchess of Hohenberg, would probably have missed or merely injured the Archduke. Or maybe amid the jostling crowd, the undersized assassin would have failed to get off a shot altogether. Had any of these scenarios ensued, then the whole course of human history since that cloud-free summer Sunday that has come to mark the end of an equally cloudless era, La Belle Époque, the beautiful age, may well have proceeded differently. World War, in any event, would not likely have broken out a month later. Of course, this still leaves the conspiracy-laden question of why the altered itinerary was not followed in the first place. But assuming that it was merely some miscommunication from Potiorek or a mental lapse on Loika's part, and there is no evidence whatsoever to suggest otherwise, then had human error not interfered and the car had proceeded along the Appel K, Princip would have been left gazing from behind at the Archduke's green plumage. In that case, he may have taken a cue from his hero Zhirayich and killed himself instead of the heir to the Habsburg Empire. The alternative outcomes are virtually endless and endlessly intriguing. At issue here, however, is an altogether different proposition. Unheralded though he is, Bogdan Zhirayich's failure to shoot Franz Josef swerved the course of history just as much as the legendary wrong turn did 4 years later. Who, after all, could say what would have happened had the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, the dual monarchy, been assassinated and Franz Ferdinand had ascended the throne in 1910? Or, for that matter, how history might have unfolded if Franz Josef had been killed in February 1853, over a decade before his nephew was born, when a Hungarian nationalist knifed him in the neck, and the quirky combination of a stiff military collar, a quick-acting Irish count, and a passing butcher had saved the Kaiser's life. Nor is every historical turning point so dramatic. In April 1914, the 83-year-old emperor was gravely ill with pneumonia. The Vienna dailies kept hourly vigils, and Franz Ferdinand's carriage in Konopiszta, Bohemia, was at the ready to whisk him to the capital for a quick coronation. If Europe's longest reigning monarch had not recovered, it's unlikely that the newly crowned Kaiser would have gone to Bosnia to inspect the troops when he could have sent his affable nephew, Karl. Then again, the Hungarians may already have revolted under Franz Ferdinand's firm authoritarian tendencies. Or, perhaps, as potentate, he would have moved that summer's military maneuvers to his beloved Bohemia from scorching Bosnia, since concerns about the southern heat had almost kept the Archduke from going to Sarajevo in the first place. This book is not a foray into the fraught and infinite, even if often illuminating, minefield of counterfactual what-if history. Nor does it presume to elevate the lesser-known figure of Bogdan Zhirayich to the storied status of Gavrilo Princip, who has been dubbed the greatest murderer of all time, the schoolboy who started the World War, the most important person in the 20th century, and the man who changed the century. Indeed, in any number of historical construals, Princip's handful of bullets have been blamed for everything from the 10 million deaths in World War I to the Bolshevik Revolution, the Great Depression, the rise of fascism, the decline of Europe, the fall of Yugoslavia, and all the tragedies and atrocities that epitomize the past century. Instead, this work on the Sarajevo assassination scrutinizes such rhetorical constructions and other common imprecisions by situating the so-called first shots of the First World War in a broad historical context. By what means and to what effect, it asks, have Princip's pistol shots become so fabled in the first place? This issue of what stands out in history goes to the heart of how the Sarajevo assassination is regularly portrayed and processed, recounted and recycled. When, for example, journalists turn every contemporary calamity into "our Archduke Franz Ferdinand," scholars equate the heir's murder with the mass murder of present-day terrorism, academic monographs and Austrian monuments proclaim Franz Ferdinand and his wife the first victims of the First World War, textbooks instruct that Princip's chance pistol shots in Europe's tinderbox, the violence-prone Balkans, shattered empires, and the Bosnian Serb assassin is vilified as a Serbian fanatic and fictionalized as eating a sandwich during modern history's defining flashbulb moment, do we reap greater insight into this grim past? Or rather, do such commonplace constructs manipulate historical understanding by thwarting the proper contextualization of the political murder? Such questions can be asked of any number of historic events. What drew me to them was the feeling that the Sarajevo assassination had ventured into the realm of mythology. I do not narrowly use this term in the usual historical sense of selectively narrating the past such that it imparts special significance for a specific collective living in the present. That is certainly the case for many Serbs and Bosnian Serbs who mythologize the political murder as a heroic act of South Slavic Yugoslav liberation from Austria-Hungary. More generally, what gives Sarajevo the universal resonance well captured by the word mythos is the larger-than-life way in which it looms over the last century, yet eludes full comprehensibility, much as the debate over the origins of World War I itself will never be settled. The political murder has been mythologized by inflating those random factors that nearly foiled it, by turning it into an intricate conspiracy hatched by shadowy Serbian nationalist groups and state-sponsored terrorists in the violence-ridden Balkans, by overwhelming it with counterfactual conjecture, by too easily incorporating such complete fictions as Princip's sandwich and the terminally ill with tuberculosis assassins, by exploiting it as a ready analogy for present-day woes, and by encumbering the mournful outcome, which almost failed, one scholar earnestly relates, with the mundane rhetoric of chance and fate, and an overblown idiom like the most portentous assassination in history. It is such language as shots that shook the world and flashbulb event, which in its immediate aftermath had confined and fleeting international impact, that gives Sarajevo the kind of blithe simplicity and blissful clarity that characterize mythology. The supposedly picture-perfect weather in Bosnia and across Europe on June 28, 1914, and even throughout the continent's last summer, is a case in point, as it creates the illusion that all was sweetness and light during La Belle Époque, when out of the clear blue sky, some half-crazy Serbian boy from a backward Balkan land instantly plunged humanity into icy darkness. Or, as Austrian writer Stefan Zweig would later lament it, in a single second, this secure world was smashed into a thousand pieces like a hollow clay vessel. The Sarajevo assassination, with its wildly disproportionate consequences, is one of the great dramas of modern history, yet it need not be dramatized in order to be told compellingly. By embedding the events of June 28, 1914 in their complex long-term context, this book is not breaking any new methodological ground. By situating the assassination in the wide spectrum of human experience, Misfire is neither upsetting historical norms nor censuring historians. Rather, the thrust of the work, as the title implies, is to recalibrate a renowned act whose elaborations are legion, from how, when, and where it happened, to who was behind it, why they did it, and what was effected. Gavrilo Princip himself has been subjected to several mythic interpretations, including murderous terrorist, heroic freedom fighter, degenerate criminal, pop cultural icon, and post-pubescent hooligan. And his alleged weapons suppliers in Serbia have been turned into the actual instigators of the epic intrigue, the fanatic Serb terrorists of the ultra-nationalist Black Hand secret society. As for the physical setting of the Sarajevo assassination, Europe's dangerous Balkan periphery seems never able to escape stereotypes of its primitive, violent, and unruly essence. In the 1930s, American journalist John Gunther decreed it an intolerable affront to human and political nature that these parochial and miserable and wretched and shriveled little countries in the Balkan Peninsula can and do have quarrels that cause world wars. Scores of other writers have scorned the barren and dusty region's Balkan savagery, Oriental indolence, pagan Serb hordes, and splendid taste for starting wars. What else could one expect from this savage patch of civilized Europe, wrote a British historian and politician in 1935, than the deadly spark for World War I? Nearly 80 years later, another scholar depicted the murder as a random event in an Austro-Hungarian backwater. Like the relentless onslaught of climate change, the global crisis of 1914 did not randomly arise in some murky Balkan backwater far removed from the consciousness and concerns of political elites. The Habsburg Empire, a European great power, became directly involved in the development of Bosnia-Herzegovina after assuming its administration from the Ottoman Empire in 1878. When the dual monarchy annexed the dominion in 1908, the Reichsland, imperial domain, for which Sarajevo was capital, gave rise not only to numerous assassination plots, but also to one of the most severe diplomatic crises in pre-war Europe. 4 years later, the Balkan Wars brought the continent's great powers so close to conflict that the British weekly Punch depicted their leaders trying to keep the lid on a boiling cauldron of Balkan troubles. Despite the persistent image of a spontaneous murder in some wild, remote, and regressive country, Bosnia was a vital component of a geopolitical conundrum going back more than a century, and serious enough to earn a name: the Eastern Question, or what would become of the European lands long controlled by the waning Ottoman Empire, aka the sick man of Europe. The Eastern Question is crucial to this book's historical narrative, though by no means at the expense of other political forces or the social, cultural, and economic dynamics shaping the world during what was one of its most transformative times. French poet Charles Peguy noted in 1910 that civilization has changed more in the past 30 years than it has since the time of Christ. Scholars have consistently seconded this. Change is the law of life, and most ages are ages of transition, conceded cultural historian Peter Gay. In the 19th century, though, the very nature of change underwent a change. It was more rapid and more irresistible than in the past. This study thus devotes the first chapter to the broad arc of the era before a gigantic and dark horizon of suffering and misfortune descended upon Europe. By the same token, the intervening and all-important post-June 28th period receives appreciable attention in the last chapter. In many narratives, the assassination is signaled as the spark or trigger for a war that was long in the making. Once all the intrinsic intrigue, action, and enigma surrounding Sarajevo have been exhaustively examined, these works pay little, if any, attention to the decisive history of the July diplomatic crisis following the June murders. Yet in recent years, several rigorous surveys of the month that changed the world have again demonstrated the perils of too much determinism when it comes to querying the war's complex origins. If authors are to pursue Princip's impassioned mindset to the extent of trekking through Bosnia in his footsteps and tracking down his report card, if Franz Ferdinand's happy marriage can be hyped as the romance that changed the world, if journalists can compare the Archduke's murder to everything from mass murder in a Florida nightclub to Russia's invasion of Crimea, and if scholars can analogize Sarajevo to 9/11, then it is also critical to investigate the varying convictions of the veritable decision-makers. Only then can we see just how close Europe came to not going to war in the wake of the outrage that allegedly changed everything. The penniless assassin inadvertently set off an international crisis, but it was a prosperous group of powerful statesmen who lit the illustrious powder keg. These men, moreover, lived in a period so replete with anarchist propaganda by the deed and other deadly forms of popular protest that there was nothing particularly unusual about the Archduke's violent demise, aside from the geopolitical context in which it took place. And even if British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli's remark after Abraham Lincoln's murder that assassination has never changed the history of the world sounds laughable in light of Sarajevo, the truth is that the decisions for war were not taken to avenge Franz Ferdinand, nor were they made in the dismal Bosnian capital, despite the anguished sentiments of such writers as Austrian Josef Roth, innocent city laden with curses, melancholy sheath for the most frightful catastrophes, and American Edmund Stillman, Why Should an Age Have Died Here? Nor, it must be stressed, were the World War and subsequent dissolution of Austria-Hungary somehow inevitable. Not only was the assassination an exceedingly close call, but so too were many of the battles that could have altered the war's outcome. What is knowable is that without that global conflagration, scores of writers would never have invested so much effort into unraveling the event that made history take a decisive turn, as eminent Habsburg expert Robert Kahn put it. The culpability question, what group or individual or individuals initiated and organized history's perfect political murder, is understandably central to studies of the Sarajevo assassination. It also entreats an engrossing answer, at least one that lives up to all the enthralling rhetoric about Princip's pistol shots upending everything in world history. Yet, like the war's origins generally, it is difficult to say conclusively who instigated the conspiracy, not to mention what motivated them. As for what followed from June 28, 1914, this much we can say. Financial markets remained perfectly calm. The unhappy obituaries soon gave way to surging issues like the Ulster crisis in Ireland and a crime of passion case in France. Even in the Austrian capital, a leading paper described public reaction to the political murder as a kind of paralysis rather than an outcry, while some noted that apathy reigned over anxiety. Sarajevo was more like a sad headline than a heart-stopping preview of the upcoming era. Or, as the authors of one study assert, unlike a spark in the tinderbox, the killings by themselves caused nothing. Nevertheless, as Stefan Zweig's golden age of security ground on, and Europeans carried on with their summer holidays, many in countries with which they would soon be at war, statesmen anxiously awaited Vienna's reaction. And they continued waiting until most people assumed the affair had blown over, just like previous international crises. Only on July 23rd, nearly 4 weeks after the Archduke's murder, were major tremors felt in the form of the Habsburg monarchy's belligerent ultimatum to the Kingdom of Serbia, whose own nationalists sought to incorporate Bosnia-Herzegovina and possibly other Slavic parts of the empire into a Greater Serb or Yugoslav state. In the making, within days of the murder, this ultimatum was not designed to be accepted, since war on Serbia had already been decided on in Vienna. Of course, the dual monarchy did its due diligence, investigating the murders to the greatest and swiftest extent possible. Yet the findings came back ambiguous. The weapons were provided by a Serbian officer and state employee. Some were manufactured under Serbian license, and the Bosnian conspirators who secured the weapons and were taught how to use them in the Serbian capital of Belgrade slipped across the border and into Bosnia with the illegal assistance of Serbian customs and military intelligence officials. Otherwise, as the lead Austro-Hungarian investigator wired from Sarajevo to Vienna on July 13th, there was absolutely no evidence tying official Serbia to the assassination conspiracy. Had such a smoking gun surfaced during the July crisis, then Russia would not likely have supported a regicidal rogue regime, and the Habsburg Empire would have gotten the war that the head of its armed forces, Konrad von Hotzendorf, had long wanted. A local Balkan bludgeoning of a nation-state that seemed existentially bent on breaking up the dual monarchy and enfolding its South Slavic peoples, Serbs and Bosnians certainly, but perhaps too Croats and Slovenes, into an expansive Great Serbian or Yugoslav state. Such a so-called Third Balkan War, following close on the heels of the first two fought in 1912-1913 among the new Balkan states and the Ottoman Empire, may not have gone easily for Austria-Hungary. Despite Serbia's smaller size and scarcer resources, its army was highly trained and battle-hardened. Nevertheless, with the other great powers out of the picture, it would have been a different...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?